Tunse, Okamawa Pistanet Sigasan, Nehyan of Sikopak Muskochis, Treaty 6, Otinia, Mikwak Pei de Loire. Hi, hi, and thank you for joining me today here on my podcast, Metawewin. I'm your host, Elijah Buffalo, and I'm calling time on season one of Metawewin. I want to thank everyone who's participated and given support to this project, the guests, the listeners, and my family. For the next few months, I'm focused on a research project that I'll publish as a comprehensive solo podcast, accompanied with some detailed show notes, where I'll take the opportunity to share the research into health and sports and culture that I'm doing. I'm also excited to be attending my second Indigenous Public Health Institute through UBC's Center for Excellence in Indigenous Health, and as well, I have a couple more projects coming up that I'll be able to share more about in the near future. Today's episode is with Dr. Michael Yellowbird, and it's the first time I have a chance to sit down with someone doing similar research to me into the molecular processes of colonization that are expressed through disease. We only had about an hour to chat, so we only scratched the surface on the depth of these issues, but it was great to get into these areas of knowledge and to talk about how this knowledge is being studied to solve and improve the health of Indigenous people. All right, so with that, please enjoy this chat. My guest today is Dr. Michael Yellowbird. He's the Dean and Professor of the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Manitoba, and he is a member of the three affiliated tribes, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara from North Dakota. His research focuses on the effects of colonization and methods of decolonization, ancestral health, and looking at interventions such as fasting, molecular decolonization, and mindfulness. So Michael, I'll hand it over to you now to introduce yourself and share a bit about your life, and yeah, we'll get into your research.
Well, thank you, Elijah. It's really great to be with you this morning. Thank you for the invitation to be part of your show here, your podcast. I am, as you said, a member of the three affiliated tribes. Our territory is in North Dakota. I grew up there on the reservation and spent a lot of time going from university, you know, being at different universities, having different academic appointments in my academic career. Still maintain a very close relationship with folks at home and all throughout, actually, you know, Indigenous country through North America. So I have been here at the University of Manitoba for about 2.5 years, so I'm on Treaty One territory here. And it's been a real pleasure to be here working. It's been challenging during the pandemic and you know, with a lot of big changes happening, you know, and me coming to a new position, leadership position. But I've still managed to kind of maintain a lot of my writing and work and speaking and visiting and interacting and engaging with the Indigenous communities in Manitoba and throughout the world, really. So it's been a busy life, a very busy life these last couple of years during the pandemic. And I've really enjoyed the opportunities to collaborate, you know, online and through Zooms with people I've never met before except on Zoom. And that's been pretty cool. Kind of have that conversation and share, you know, mutual kinds of, you know, thinking and research and interests that we have. So
can you tell me a little bit about the field of social work and how you got into it? And for some of us, like myself, I have a bit of a limited view of the field of social work. And throughout my research, it's coming up more and more about how it's being used to further our self-determination and things like that, and also just the overall healing of communities. So if you wouldn't mind, could you just maybe go into a bit of the field itself and how you got into it?
Yeah, sure. Well, the field generally is about, the ethics of social work and the code of ethics, I guess, is one of the things that folks look at a lot to kind of determine, you know, really what the field kind of, how it's framed. And it's framed, you know, with the idea of respect for, you know, diversity, social justice, respect for the individual, a number of things like that in the ethics. It sounds good, but, you know, the reality is social work, like a lot of other human service professions and helping professions are centered in colonial structures. And that's difficult. I mean, it's And on the one hand, you have social workers that mean well. Not all of them mean well, but many mean well. And they try to do the best they can, but a lot of times they're hamstringed and they're prevented from doing some of the work that they really know is ethically right to do by the systems that are in place. And so that's a constant kind of struggle that's happening in social work, really around the world. And so, you know, it's something I call the social work industrial complex. You know, it's where, you know, social workers are professionally trained, they're trained really well. And then it's gotten better and better over the years. But again, confined, you know, with some of the things they can do. So that's kind of social work in a real fast kind of snapshot of it. How I got into it was I when I first went to school, it's kind of an interesting story. I went and I was taking courses in special education. So I wanted to be a teacher. And I also was taking courses in social work. This is back in the early 70s. And I got to the point where I was thinking, like, now I've been in school a long time. Where, you know, what am I going to do with my degree? What, you know, where am I at? So I went to see my advisor, who was an Anishinaabe advisor. It was kind of rare, you know, to have other Indians on campus. So, you know, I had him as an advisor in social work. He's a real cool guy. And so he sat down one afternoon, took a look at all my credit hours. And I said, what am I closest to in terms of my graduation? Because I'm ready to graduate and ready to get out of here, you know. And he said, well, you're pretty close. He said, you're taking a lot of courses in education and social work. He said, but you're closer by one class in social work. And I said, okay, I'm going to be a social worker. And that's how it really ended up. But throughout the course of social work, I really came to understand that, you know, social work was about trying to help people. And it was during that kind of shift in the 70s where I think curriculum was kind of making, and people who were teaching it, you know, where I was at the University of North Dakota, were really a really great bunch of people because they were very sympathetic to what was happening with Indian people at, you know, my part of the country and around the world, North America. And so they're very supportive. And of course, being the only Native student in the class, they had to, you know, go to me and kind of talk about, like, well, what are things like out there on the reservation? What is it like with Native people, you know? So I was kind of like one of those cultural interpreters for the profession very early on, talking about like what it was like, you know, because people living in the same state, and very few of them had ever been to the reservation. So that's what it was like. And it was also during the time of, like, you know, just around Wounded Knee that was happening, Alcatraz Island, these, you know, movements are going on. And a lot of people were writing, you know, Vine Deloria was writing books and people were reading some of that stuff in academia, which was interesting just to see that. And so there, and of course, the civil rights movement had already been kind of in process a few years, Vietnam War, where a lot of Native Americans or and indigenous soldiers were going to Vietnam, coming back and realizing that, you know, I've heard this when I was a young person, that they're talking about how, you know, these imperialist forces like the United States had, you know, kind of taken them and put them into a situation where, you know, they ended up killing poor farmers in Vietnam who were like them, the same color. So it was like that kind of consciousness raising was happening at that point. And it was good for me to hear that, because I had two sisters that lived in the Bay Area, and both of them had been out to Alcatraz Island. And I had friends who were in South Dakota that had been at Wounded Knee. And so there's a lot of activism going on at the same time. So I never just really bought 100% into, you know, the academic world. I mean, that was part of who I was, but the other part was we were living in this really dramatic paradigm, you know, a political shift that was happening. I'm coming all the way from the West Coast back into North Dakota to the plains, where people were talking about liberation and freedom and revolution and change and you know, indigenous rights. So we didn't get that in the classroom, essentially, but I was getting it, you know, kind of as kind of a teaching tool outside of that. And then from that point, when I graduated and got my BSW or BSSW, it was a Bachelor of Science in Social Work, I was very, very fortunate to get accepted into a graduate MSW program at the University of Milwaukee, and to have as a professor there, Dr. Ronald Lewis, who was the first Native American to ever get a PhD in social work. You know, and it was like, you know, it was really a special person, a mentor. He was my professor. He was a support. And there was a cohort, probably about 8 of us, that ended up going to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, under his mentorship. And he had written a grant, a mental health training grant, because he said, you know, there was a lot of things that we saw. I grew up with, you know, a lot of substance abuse, a lot of violence, a lot of mortality, sickness that was happening in the reservation. We didn't realize that it was colonization. We just thought that, you know, this is what, you know, we weren't adapting well to the white man's way. You know, of course, we were very naive, you know, as young people at that time. But seeing on the other side, which was good, the political talk of Native people that were saying, yeah, it is colonization. So we had to kind of really fit that, you know, into our framework of thinking. So very fortunate. And Ron Lewis is, you look him up, he's identified as the father of Indian social work in the United States. And he was at Wounded Knee. He was at Alcatraz Island. So it was very cool to me to kind of be in his classroom when he would talk about these kinds of things, because my sisters were there and my older brother was working on language programs way back when. So folks were doing activism way back when. So I was sitting in the class and he was, you know, just very exceptional. He understood, you know, the world that we lived in. And I was just writing to someone recently from Sitting Bull College down in North Dakota. And they had asked me about Ron Lewis. And so I wrote them back. I said, you know, I said, they asked me, did we have any special kind of training? I said, well, having the first Indian professor in social work, I said, that was the ultimate training. The discourse, the examples, the connections, and the understanding of what it was to grow up into a tribal community was all sort of on point, that we talked about all the time. And I said, you know, another thing he did was he checked in with us very regularly to talk about how our classes were going, what we were learning, how we would apply that to when we went home back to our reservations, you know, because we were from different places in Wisconsin, I think in Minnesota and North Dakota, that were on this training grant. So then at the very end, you know, of the program, the last ending of the program, he had a training leadership program connected to our education, where he brought in John Redhorse. John Redhorse was writing very early about Indian social work. I mean, this guy is a very prolific, very intelligent man. And Redhorse was another Native professor, then another Native professor by the name of Eddie Brown. So it was so rich for us and rare to have that experience. You know, so my social work was influenced a lot by those folks, and also Ada Deer, who was in Wisconsin at the time. She was involved in the Menominee restoration when the Menominees were had lost their land and been I guess they had lost their land rights, but you know, and she was a social worker. So I was very fortunate to be surrounded by these people, and to be a strong cohort of other Native students. So, and we knew that you know, social work had changed dramatically. So that, you know, and Ron Lewis said to me, he said, you know, Michael, he said, when you go home, so you go home back to the reservation, people are going to be looking up to you because you're going to be one of the few guys with a MSW. And he said, when you go about to set into motion change on the reservation, he said, you can't just start some program and hang a couple eagle feathers on it and think it's a, you know, a Native program. He said, that ain't the way it works. He said, you have to go back to the culture and to the learning and the teachings of the people. He was really clear. I've written about this in a book that I published in a couple of other areas. And that was very profound, you know, to hear him say that, to go back to the traditions of the people. He said, because, you know, our people knew how to take care of one another. They knew how to live their lives, he said. But, and he was the first person I heard use the term colonization, you know, colonization and decolonization. He talked about these things way back, you know, in the 70s. So that was kind of my social work experience. So I've come at it in that way, always, you know, as a Native social work professor. It hasn't been easy as a Native social work professor, because when you talk about these kinds of things with a largely white student body as a professor, I mean, you get a lot of blowback, man, from students. You know, they don't like you. They say, well, this professor here hates white people. Well, why? You know, because you talk about broken treaties. You talk about, you know, the horrible things that happen in residential school and boarding schools, and and all these, you know, land loss, the broken, you know, all this broken promises and all these kinds of things. And when you point those things out, it's, and then they say, well, when I was in the States, they say, well, this guy hates the United States because he says all this bad stuff, right? But that was my forum. And of course, that I had to go through that. You know, that's kind of like a hazing that you had that I had to go through as a professor. But I kept it up, you know, and I'm proud to say that, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, we stay true to is, I think, going through that Ron Lewis's training program is that, you know, Indigenous social work was about sovereignty. It was about Indigenous rights. It was about cultural rights. It wasn't so much about, carrying out the wishes of the state, but it was how do we balance this stuff with who we are? So I was fortunate, very fortunate to have that kind of experience.
Wow, yeah, that sounds like, you know, early on in your education that Indigenous knowledge was such an inclusive part of it. So when I'm trying to think about the context of your work that I've been exposed to that really involves these different areas of knowledge that some people categorize as being so different from each other, such as the Western sciences. Yeah, just hearing how you explain that really puts it into context of how you're able to include that body of work into the decolonization process. And so I'm just thinking about, yeah, like looking at the processes of decolonization and focusing on the root of the issues and just including different areas of knowledge and education into solving the problem. And yeah, it's interesting that your first degree, you mentioned it was a Bachelor of Science in Social Work. That just seems really interesting. I don't know too much about the way that the degree programs are structured, but just, it's like really puts into perspective the ideas that we put around knowledge and, you know, what is going to be science and what is going to be viewed as like, you know, I guess not science. But yeah, I guess if you could go into a little bit about these areas of decolonization that you've written about, such as neurodecolonization, and maybe just for the sake of time, we could jump right into the molecular decolonization. And that's interesting to me because that's the focus of my research, and what drew me towards yours was the mentioning of these conditions of colonialism and how things like diabetes are affecting us on the cellular and molecular level. And yeah, if you wanted to just go into the work that you do there, that'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Elijah. Well, a lot of my work, as you said, more recently, the last probably 10 or 15 years has been around decolonization. I have to first give credit where credit is due. I had never heard of the term colonization used in social work other than when Ron Lewis had talked about it way back when I was doing a PhD at Madison, Wisconsin, my PhD in social work. I thought about being a professor, how am I going to approach social work? You know, of course there was all this stuff about oppression, but and there was all this stuff about, you know, racism that had been talked about and race and so on, but no one had conceptualized it very well. I said, other than Ron Lewis had talked about how colonialism worked. And of course I've had other Native professors too. And as a PhD student, Gary Sandifer, who was a Chickasaw, a guy from Oklahoma, really well-known sociologist, and Matt Snipp. Matt was also a sociologist. They were both on my PhD committee, and Matt was also an Indian professor, very well-known demographer. So I was lucky again as a PhD to have folks like that, but they were really good in helping to construct my thinking around decolonization to begin with. And Matt had written about Indian reservations being internal colonies, and I thought, well, that was a very novel article he wrote, and I've cited, you know, many times. And Matt is a professor still at Stanford University, and I recall thinking about how that exploitation had been happening a long time. I hadn't heard it in my mainstream classes, but I had to hear it once I got outside of social work, talking to a sociologist demographer who was Native American, and how these the exploitation of the coal and the oil and the minerals and the timber and the rivers, you know, that all were, you know, on our traditional territories had been exploited by, you know, you know, these larger neoliberal forces and capitalist corporations. And of course, they were draining, you know, their tribal lands of all this wealth and giving them nothing in return. And of course, they were taking those things and investing those in international markets. And of course, the U.S. was profiting on, you know, the suffering and of Native people, but also profiting on the destruction and exploitation of our lands. And that's why they were, like, you know, he called them internal colonies. And then he started talking about decolonization, about how important it was, you know, for people to kind of begin to overcome those systems and to use other processes, you know, in order to restore this tribal sovereignty and integrity. So from that point on, that's, you know, then I had my first teaching job at the University of British Columbia, UBC. And then I got much deeper into the decolonization literature. I saw that, boy, in Canada, there was a pipeline between Canada and Australia and New Zealand, you know, Maori people and First Nations in Canada. And a lot of discourse around decolonization. I thought, wow, this is so cool that people are talking about restoration. And decolonization was first understanding, you know, the level of colonization that people were at and what happened to them, you know, on the spiritual, on the physical, on the intellectual, the emotional levels, all these different levels. And I start reading a lot of different kinds of things, you know, that were happening by the intellectuals in both, you know, Canada and indigenous intellectuals, both Canada and Australia. And wrote a bit about that. And that's where I came up with the idea of neurodecolonization, realizing after reading some stuff about decolonizing the mind, I thought it was, you know, changing language and so on and changing thinking. But how does one do that, you know, rather than just say that? And so the brain is a very complex area. And I knew nothing about neuroplasticity, nothing about, you know, brain regions or, you know, these the different structures and functions of the brain. So I had to really start sitting down and remaking myself to become someone who could interpret neuroscience for indigenous scholars and scholarship, I should say, and for social work. That's when I really began to understand how generation after generation after generation of oppression had begun to change the neural networks of folks, and you know, people began to suffer through these periods of oppression, and of course this rumination and of the things like residential school or the trauma that people experience, you know, were very well understood, and also the grieving and you know, the depression and anxiety that followed with that is very understandable. But what I didn't realize, which I think most people didn't realize, was that long-term chronic stress and oppression then began to actually change the neural networks in people, so that people didn't recover as well. It became more complex. So we were through this grieving and through this anxiety and through this trauma, we were actually strengthening some networks in, you know, in the brain that supported that kind of feeling, rather than feeling optimistic or we can overcome, you know, that. And that's how neuroplasticity works, is that, you know, when we begin to master an action or a feeling or, you know, a way of looking at the world, you know, the neurons fire in the brain, and the more we do it, the more neurons that fire, and they wire together. And, you know, those that wire together, fire together, is kind of what they say in neuroscience. And those regions of the brain can get thicker, like we can get a more active and well-tuned amygdala, which is about fear, and which is about fight and flight, and, you know, lose our sense of optimism along the way. We don't engage other parts of the brain as well, you know, becomes more dominant in our expression, and they call that the amygdala hijack, right? But it wasn't just like your amygdala was hijacked. It was like policy, it was like racism, it was like colonialism that began to kind of restructure the amygdala in the brain. So that's kind of how I got really interested in the neuroplasticity and start thinking, wow, why? And then I also looked at some, I began to look at more recent research too around sensitivity. And I said, why is it that some Native people could walk through fire and residential schools and oppression. You know, they laugh at it and they count coup on it. You know, so how can they do that, right? And why is it that some others are so vulnerable to it? And then, of course, more research started coming out in genetic research, which is part of, you know, I think what I call neurodecolonization is understanding that and start thinking that, well, there are differences in population. Some people are painters and they're artists and they're poets and they're very sensitive people. And, you know, they make artwork and they engage in at a very sensitive level, you know, whatever it is, they talk or they feel very sensitive. And these are the people that, you know, it's now been discovered they're a bit more vulnerable to stress and chronic, you know, conditions of oppression. And probably the people that are more likely to, you know, harm themselves, commit suicide or get depression, long-term depression or anxiety disorders. And today the research refers to those as orchid kids, like an orchid flower that's very delicate. So I'm trying to frame that like in an indigenous way and call it the wild rose of the prairie or something that's more delicate. And then there's other kids that, like I was mentioned, can walk through fire. Or they went to residential school, they maybe lost their parents and they recovered, you know, fairly quickly. And it's like, you know, the saying, that, you know, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And that's kind of the resilience that we see in some Native people in the community. So it's really important, you know, in decolonization that we don't look at is everyone is a victim, that there are some people out there that have, you know, maintained this integrity of emotion and their feeling and so on. And the other people that have, you know, struggled with it, those are the people that we need to really care about and have compassion for and understand them, you know. And not just think, well, you're weak or you're, you know, you're this or you're that. And I think that's what decolonization has taught me, is that it happens at a different rate and pace for people. And I think we have to embrace that. And I think that's one of the things we see in many indigenous communities is those high rates of suicide and depression and anxiety are probably people who have a very different genetic variant that make them more sensitive to conditions around them. So, that's what neurodecolonization was for me, was understanding that, well, gosh, you know, what, you know, it's happening in the genetic level, you know, because we, some of these people like myself, you know, we inherit different genetic variants from ancestors. I'm very different than my older brother, who was a Vietnam era veteran. He was a special forces force recon in the Marines during the era of Vietnam. And he's a guy who walks through fire. You know, I don't walk through fire. I'm much more sensitive than he is. He's the kind of person who's like my mother. My mother is like that. She walks through fire too. She'd say, don't think about that bad stuff. It's going to get you. Stay optimistic, right? And it would ruminate in my head. My brother is the same way. He says, well, there's nothing to do about it. And this happens. He said, you've got to do the best you can and be strong and move and get up. And so I've got family members kind of on both sides that are very sensitive. And some of them walk through fire kind of people. And it's not, you know, that's the difference we have, you know, in communities. And then I start looking at it more deeply at the molecular level. I start thinking about, like, how does it affect us? How does colonization affect us? And how does the oppression and the demeaning sort of things that happen to us under colonialism, what does it affect us, you know, at a very deep level? And then in my research, and like I say myself, I'm always trying to remake myself as an intellectual and a scholar. So that pulls me into another area of research. I start looking at study of telomeres and chromosomes, which I knew nothing about. And they train us nothing in social work about that. But it's very important because we understand that now from this work, a kind of molecular colonization, is that we can be colonized at a very, very deep level, at a molecular level. The telomeres that are at the end of our chromosomes are the material that keep our chromosomes young and have a particular level of integrity. And they shorten naturally as our cells divide, and, you know, we get older. But people who exercise a lot, that, you know, and they laugh a lot, they have a good sense of humor, they're around positive people, they eat, you know, good traditional foods, and they fast and they do the things like our ancestors did. They sleep well, they laugh well, they, you know, they have all, and they dance hard, they sing, you know, traditional songs, things that make them good. feel good, you know, raise their level of endocannabinoids in their brains and their endorphins in their brains. And it brings, you know, a sense of a well-being. And that's what endocannabinoids do. They're actually like pain relievers. So when you get out and you do a real hard, fast dance, happy dance, and you're doing, you know, you're in the finals for, you know, a grass dance, or you're doing whatever you're doing, and you're smiling and you're feeling it, you can, and you're getting tired, but you're still feeling strong, and you get that second wind, as they call it, or you get that, you know, like the dancer's high or the runner's high, you can be sure that your levels of endocannabinoids are going up in your brain. They protect your brain. They keep your telomeres from disintegrating. You know, you're getting the thrive experience in your body. Your body is saying thrive, thrive. It's not saying decay. And I think when you take away dancing like that from people, and you ban their singing and the meaning of song and dances, then of course you're going to have destruction in your telomeres, because your telomeres expand when you're thriving, and they begin to shrink when, you know, you're under oppression and chronic stress. So that's molecular colonization. So what do? You turn around and you start, and, you know, you start dancing again, you start singing again, you start, you know, fasting again, those kinds of things, and exercising hard and eating well, those things, and sleeping well, those are all those kinds of things that are going to grow the telomeres. And that's molecular decolonization at that level. Well, it happens to other parts of our body. And that's one example I'll get into. And the same thing with the brain. When we start thinking in optimistic ways, and we always come back, you know, to like, I've got a slide that I show in my pictures of one of my fellow tribesmen way back in 1903, I think, when Edward Curtis took some pictures of us back in the plains, when they said, all the Indians are going to disappear, so we got to take pictures of them, right? But we didn't disappear. There's more of us now. And there's this guy, I think his name is Little Brave or Little Sioux. He's sitting there over four pipes, sacred pipes, in the medicine lodge. And there's a picture taken of him. He's sitting there in this position, you know, like he could be meditating, you know, in Tibet or something like that. Because indigenous people had meditation, right? They used all these contemplative practices. But when I looked at him, the first time I looked at him, before I knew the neuroscience, I was like, he's really in a sacred, you know, kind of space here, looking at these pipes, these sacred, you know, pipes. And then when I started learning more about neuroscience, I thought, wow, this is really what's happening with his brain. And one of my colleagues, a guy by the name of Andrew Newberg, Andrew Newberg is a neuroscientist, and in the States, he wrote this book, How God Changes Your Brain. So I found some of his work, and I wrote him and asked him if I could use some of his slides in my work. And he asked me how I was using it. And I said, I'm using it to demonstrate what's happening in the brains of Native people when they're doing ceremony. And he said, it sounds really interesting. And I told him how, and he said, yeah, go ahead and use it. So I use it in the slide now. And this guy, Little Sue, is sitting above these pipes, and he's focusing on the pipes. And what happens to his brain, you know, it's pretty phenomenal. The left prefrontal cortex, just above the left eye, the eyebrow, is the part of the brain that research has shown is associated with a sense of well-being, of optimism, being happy. So when he looks at these pipes and he sees that sacredness in the pipes and how strong they are and the medicine that it holds, that part of his brain activates. So he gets a sense of well-being, a sense of optimism, a sense of happiness. And the more he sees those, the stronger the activation, you know, in the left prefrontal cortex of the brain, and the longer and thicker that the activation is. And pretty soon, all he has to do is be walking around the village or downtown, someplace like that, think about that sacred, those sacred pipes, and that's going to activate his optimism in that part of the brain. Another part of his brain I showed that, you know, in the picture is the occipital lobe, which is the very back part of the skull, which is the seeing part of the brain. And that activates too when a person is having this very deep experience looking at something very sacred, right? Could be the water, could be, watching people, you know, do ceremony, could be those pipes I was talking about. Anything that's sacred, that's meaningful to people, will activate that as they're seeing it, and it gets more and more activation as the person begins to visualize. For example, in this particular slide, this man is visualizing that, where did the stems come from? Well, they came from these willows, and they were gathered in a very sacred way. Tobacco was laid down, these songs were sung, and it was done in this fashion. So of course, in his mind, he's seeing that. The brain doesn't know he's not there. He's just remembering that. So it's activating the occipital lobe. It gets stronger and stronger so that he actually is able to see those kinds of things happening. And he may even be seeing the elders and the people generations earlier that handed down those pipes in a very sacred way. And that makes that activation even stronger in the brain. Happens to all of us, but I'm talking about the sacred now. And the more he does that through ceremony, the more activation he gets. And again, the brain is, you know, we evolve to be creative and imaginative. So the brain does that. And of course, that's how some people can get through long periods of repression. Say they're locked up and put away in a prison in isolation. They begin to imagine and visualize those kinds of things that keep their brain active. And that's the creativity we have as a brain. And that's why colonization was one of those things that attacked, you know, our ability to kind of be connected to those things and to maintain, an understanding of the sacredness. And then that separation that happened, that broken, kind of left many of us sort of floating out there. How do we heal ourselves? What do we do? And of course, they try to replace that with different kinds of things that were meaningful to them, but were not meaningful to our people. So, and of course, that's part of, you know, what the molecular colonization is all about. It's happening at different parts of the brain where it's changing how neurons fire and how you know, activation happens in different parts of the body. So, so I always look at what our people did. You know, whether it was singing, dancing, or whether there's a lot of things that I've looked at recently too about dancing, because dancing is, when you take a deep dive into dancing, there's so many cool things about dancing that you realize not only does it, you know, raise endocannabinoids in the brain, dancing does that, just like singing does. Singing is very powerful. But when you use different kinds of poses when you dance, when you think about all the dances indigenous people did, bear dances, eagle dances, you know, deer dances. I was among the Menominees and among the Winnebagos and some of the people in Wisconsin when I was doing my PhD. And I used to go up there and visit the reserves up there. And boy, they did snake dances, fish dances. And it was like, wow, you know, it was so cool when you see that. And I've seen buffalo dances and bear dances when I was in California. And when I was a kid, I saw buffalo dances and eagle dances. So these indigenous people doing these things, but you realize the same thing, you know, at that kind of molecular and cellular level and that neurochemical level. When people raise their arms, for example, and start moving their arms above their head, we know that levels of testosterone go up, right? And levels of norepinephrine alert chemicals go up. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing it, and you're dancing with all your buddies, your friends, the level of oxytocin levels go up. Like this is my family. These are my people, right? And that's healing. You know, that's a very, very healing thing that happens. And of course, levels of cortisol, which are adrenaline-like factors that you create flight and fight levels go down. Dopamine levels go up, which is a reward chemical. If you're doing certain kinds of dances, like eagle dances, are very creative, you know, relaxing and thoughtful, sacred dances, serotonin levels will go up. And we know that when people dance together in unison, it sort of supercharges, you know, those emotions and that chemistry, which is why human beings, you know, dance, you know, all human beings dance, you know, as like birds fly together. If you've ever seen those birds that fly together, all in unison, they're called murmurations. So you see thousands and thousands of birds flying, you know, in these patterns, or they call it schooling among fish. They all sort of roll in this big ball, you know, under the ocean. And so, you know, I think our people understood that, those kinds of things, being out there on the land and being in nature, that we, those observations we made. And I think this is something to me that I've tried to bring into social work, to try to talk about people and say, listen, you know, if we're ever going to do any healing work, we have to go back to what's really important to the people, what was important to our ancestors, what they did, what they thought, and how they behaved and what they valued and what was important to them. I mean, you have to remember, these people survived earthquakes and tornadoes and climate change and major different, you know, droughts and those kinds of things, and continue to thrive and grow in Turtle Island, You know, these people, they didn't die off. They thrived, and the numbers were just, you know, teeming. And our people built towns and villages and confederacies and empires. And yet we were hunter-gatherers. You know, we had all these different kinds of civilizations and cultures. So that long, long preceded, you know, Western culture. So when I think about social work, I think these are the kinds of things that we have to decolonize the discipline around, to understand that long before you were trying to remove our kids, long before you were trying to take away our rights and do these kinds of things, our people lived in this world that was, you know, unimaginable in Europe at that time. And that's what, you know, people say is like, you couldn't find cities as large as there were in Mesoamerica among indigenous people, or even in Middle America and Cahokia, where you had huge populations of indigenous people that were coming from all over Turtle Island that were collecting in certain places. And, you know, I call it like the indigenous Silk Road, because there were all this trading that was going on from area to area all across, you know, all across Turtle Island. So that's pretty clear. So I think those things that people were doing, you know, thousands of years ago, and many of those genes we still have that molecular as well as that, you know, genetic material that we have from ancestors, which is why, you know, some of us can thrive really well under many conditions and be creative and do these kinds of things, and why we didn't fade away and all die off, that we thrived and we've become even more complex. So it's getting to that understanding of what's happening at that level, and how that colonization at the molecular and cellular levels needs to be addressed again by a lot of different kinds of traditional kinds of practices.
Yeah, just a couple things that popped out of me was the description of the sensitivity, and then going into creativity and unpacking the process of how creativity is a molecular process linked to the either strengthening or de-strengthening of the neural networks and genetic expression, and how that's related to ceremony, and then bringing in the aspect of cultural practices such as dance, and how at the base it's a physical activity that's occurring coupled with the ceremonial aspect and communal aspect. And so what's going on with the dancing from a physical activity standpoint is that it's turning on a certain metabolic flux in the cells of the body to process our nutrients and such. But then this, coupled with that creativity and that molecular process, is really turning on this whole body experience that is having a positive health outcome. Yep. And yeah, so that's just something that I pieced together as you were talking. And, you know, it really helps for me to understand these processes and how they are linked, and
right,
and how so many people talk about what we need to do is go back to ceremony, going back to eating properly, as you said, doing fasting as well, and sleeping. And one thing that I've been thinking about lately is the fact that if you look at most people that are into health and talking about things that we need to do to improve our health and to sustain a healthy existence, is that sleep is important. And we always hear in indigenous cultures that it's important to respect the cycles of the earth with, you know, if it's light out, it's time to get up. And if it's dark out, it's time to go to bed. But one thing that I find interesting is that dreams are so important to indigenous people to inform our worldview. And through this process of colonization, the fact that sleep is disrupted, and in turn, our dreams are disrupted. And so that, you know, it's disrupting the quality of sleep that we have and dreams. And so just extends to a broader example of how our existence is, disrupted from all these processes.
Yeah, it's really interesting you mentioned that too, because Elijah's is that a lot of my work too, I focus on circadian rhythms and the importance of circadian rhythms. And our circadian rhythms are governed by, you know, endogenous and exogenous kinds of things. Well, endogenous things that really inside of us that really affect our circadian rhythms is the human microbiome, our gut biome. And like you mentioned, that our gut biome, all we've got this great circle of life inside of us, man, that we just have not paid attention to. But way back in the day, we knew that we had to eat certain kinds of foods to make us feel well. And I run across historical pictures and articles in anthropology where you have elders talking about, don't eat the white man's food, man, it's poison, you know. And I cite, you know, some elders that talk about that. And this other later, Maria Chona, who was on the desert, which I think Ruth Underhill wrote about her, I believe it was. Could be wrong in that, but she was also talking about, like, you know, the white man's food makes me feel weak, you know, when I eat his bread and that sort of stuff. And when I'm feeling sick, my grandchildren go out to the desert and they collect these wild seeds for me. She said, that's good food. She said, and she was like 90 years old, still in the desert, kind of collecting, you know, her stuff. But I think that's the key thing, that people understood that there was spirit in the food. The wild food, you know, was like Maria Chona said, you know, that, you know, it's wild seeds and wild foods and all these different kinds of things that the Creator gave us. Didn't give that to the white people. They gave the white people peaches and all that other kinds of food, she said, you know. And of course, when we look at the science now, the Western science, which has finally caught up with indigenous science, right? We find out that when you feed the microbiome wild seeds and you feed them this high level of fiber, the diversity of all these bacteria in the gut just explodes. And now, you know, all the microbiome science tells us that if you have a very diverse gut biome with all these different species of bacteria that are working together, you are going to live a long, healthy life. You know, you're going to have long telomeres, that kind of thing. That's the new great circle of life that I call the great new circle of life. And that's why, you know, eating high foods and fiber that are nutrient dense, like seeds and nuts, and things that, you know, and you know, fish and wild game, things that are that people used to eat, and plants, and of course fasting, all that, even fasting, what fasting does, intermittent fasting does, and long-term fasting does, is it creates a certain kind of species called Acromantia minucephalia, which is a bacteria that makes you lean and your muscles kind of really strong. It gets you prepared for the hunt, you know. And that's why when you'd see a lot of indigenous people back in the day, they all had their, you know, they had their washboard, you know, they didn't have six packs, they had eight packs, you know, when you look at them, when they were really thriving people. But as soon as they started getting introduced to the white man's flour and sugar and stopped moving for their food and that sort of thing, and even the idea of agriculture, kind of, we had seen some decline in the strength and the bone size of indigenous people, you know, around the world. But, you know, traditional agriculture was good. It provided, you know, more food for people. But the real, you know, cream of living was wild foods and you know, hunting and gathering, which we evolved to do. You know, we didn't evolve to eat, you know, as much as we eat. So when you talk about diet, I mean, diet is critical for indigenous people. And we have these genes called FTO genes. And some people in the genetic world kind of laugh and they tease about calling, they call them fatty genes, FTO genes. Well, these particular genes, you know, we have those genes, and a lot of us are going to get obese if we eat food. You know, if we have those genes, if we have different copies of those genes. And they were very good for us at one time, because the people with the FTO genes survived the famines, because they would put on a lot of fat very quickly and they wouldn't lose it. They had slower metabolic rates. I'm one of those people. I have a slower metabolic resting rate, you know, and I've got some fatty genes from my mom's side, my dad's side, both. Mm-hmm. But I've managed, you know, to live in this world by intermittent fasting and eating a lot of fiber foods and those kinds of things, and sleeping well and exercising a lot. But a lot of people, you mentioned diabetes, we don't talk about this because we don't know that much about that science. Don't realize that when we see a person, an indigenous person who's heavy, that's success in the old world, because the next famine is coming. And when skinny guys are around or ladies are around, they're not going to survive the famine, because they're not going to have, you know, the energy to survive it. They're not going to have basically the fat or the body mass to survive it. So at one time when it was very beneficial, as we look at it today, it's what they call a mismatch, evolutionary mismatch or evolutionary trap. So this is why some people don't believe in genetic testing. I do. I think it's very valuable to kind of give us an idea of what's happening at that level, the genetic level, because it's certainly pretty clear that, you know, when people, we see people that get exposed to a particular kind of environment where there's a lot of food, a lot of fatty food, a lot of carbohydrate food, a lot of sugary food, you know, we're going to see obesity, a lot of diabetes, a lot of cancer is going to follow, a lot of Alzheimer's disease is going to follow, a lot of heart attacks is going to follow, a lot of blindness is going to follow, you know, macular degeneration. And these are, you know, and these are very high among Indigenous people, colon cancers, those kinds of things. And it, what will give us a kind of an understanding about that is whether or not we inherited some of those genes from our ancestors. One time we carry them now. We live in an epigenetic world where everything, the plasticity of the world is always changing. And, you know, if those kinds of foods are available, and if we don't hunt our own foods or grow our own foods, you know, we're kind of going down that road of destruction. So,
yeah, just looking at the time here, we just got about a minute left. I guess what I wanted to say is that, yeah, just the circular process that you mentioned with the gut microbiome and the diet and just connection to land and such is so interesting, because if we think about cell theory and the first scientist, Robert Hooke, who observed a cell at a microscopic level, called it a cell because it resembled the circular rooms that monks would pray in. And I find that so fascinating because you can translate it to Indigenous understanding of science and, you know, these circles of relationships that link us all together. And yeah, it's just, I think it's a great way to look at it. So yeah, was there anything else that you wanted to mention here before we wrap up?
Well, I think, you know, thanks. And thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. I think the one thing we can look at, you know, with clear optimism and hope is that our ancestors knew how to live. They had the right way. They had the formula for living well. So when I say that, I'm not just talking about, you know, going to a sweat lodge once a week or something, or, you know, eating some healthy Indigenous food or this or that. I'm talking about, you know, a deep dive back into who we are, I think is going to be our way out of a lot of the health and emotional and spiritual issues that we have today as Indigenous people. We talk about it a lot. We talk about decolonizing diets or this or that, but it's not just one thing. The diet is only one thing. You know, we have to kind of embrace this holistic lifestyle of our ancestors, because they were clearly right on exactly what they did. You know, everything from sleeping well, like you mentioned, to eating well, to eating enough fiber in our diet, to singing, to dancing, to you know, challenging our bodies with things like fasting and exercise, where we put ourselves into a state of mild bioenergetic stress, you know, by taking a cold shower for 5 minutes every morning, or sitting in a hot sauna, you know, at 180 mm-hmm. degrees for 20 minutes, five times a week. These things, when we impose a stress on ourselves, the research shows now, you mentioned the cellular theory, we know now that when we impose a stress, a mild bioenergetic stress on ourselves, our cells respond. They're resilient. And this is how we build cognitive, cellular, molecular, cultural resilience, you know, in our people, is by, you know, some of these things that I talked about. And, you know, dancing, singing, meditation, prayer, taking cold showers, being in hot environments, singing, you know, all these different kinds of things I mentioned are critical, mm-hmm. and diet is critical. So I'll just end with that to say that I think, you know, I'm very optimistic that we're starting to move and shift in that way. And we do, I think we're going to see the next great, you know, revolution of health and well-being among the people. We just have to turn back to who we are.
Yep. All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. It's been a pleasure. I think that we could probably talk for, you know, multiple hours here on these subjects. So I just want to thank you for taking the time. And yeah, I look forward to engaging more with your work.
All right. Thanks so much, Elijah. Appreciate it. And it was great to be on your show. Take care.
Yeah, you too.